The speaker, I also would like to thank the SERB school organizers for providing this speaker for the asset colloquium. As I said, Professor Darin received his BS from Bachelor of Sciences from the California Institute of Technology in 1987 and PhD from University of California, San Diego in 1993. He was a postdoc researcher at the Ohio State University before he joined the faculty at the University of Florida in 1997. His research in experimental high energy physics, of course, spans a very wide range of physics topics. For some of them, for new lepton quark couplings and compositeness that could arise from new forces and symmetries, searches for supersymmetric particles, standard model measurements, and searches for rare processes such as Higgs decay into dimuons. He is currently the member of CMS collaboration at the CERN LHC, of course, but more pertinent to today's talk, is an expert on the electronic trigger systems of particle collider experiments that perform real-time analysis of collision data before storing them on the computer disk. So he's going to share with us his experience as well as his excitements about building a very, very complex trigger systems for the CMS as well as those for the high luminosity CMS and also similar experiments that are coming to, you know, coming up in the horizon. So with these few words, Darin, it's all for you now. Yeah.
All right, is that on?
Yeah, I guess so.
Let's take that out. Okay, it's a pleasure to tell you a little bit about trigger electronics and some of the future directions there. I see many familiar faces from the school. And the plus side, you'll have seen and know some of this material now already, but my apologies if there's a little too much repetition. This will be the more condensed version of the lectures. So yes, I come from the University of Florida. You know, all big U.S. universities have to have a mascot for their sports teams, American football. We're the Gators. That's because Florida has these guys in pretty much anywhere there's open water that's not fenced off, you'll find one, including campus. So anyway, a little bit about Florida there. Okay, so I understand, you know, this lecture covers a lot of emerging technologies, so I'll be focusing mostly on that. So this is the outline. I will first set things in context because this is technologies applied to particle physics at the Large Hadron Collider at the CERN laboratory. That's our source of data. It's a rather big source. I'll say a few words describing what trigger systems are and what they do and the current hardware. And actually, to be honest, most of my focus, I'd like to talk toward the future developments in this area for various upgrades for the high luminosity LHC, and even embedding things like artificial intelligence into electronics, and maybe some words about the distant horizon before summarizing. So all this work is focused on the science program around the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. CERN is a facility, European-based facility near Geneva, Switzerland. It features now a 27-kilometer proton-proton collider and heavy ion collider. It has several experiments, but I've only highlighted two of the general-purpose ones, CMS here and ATLAS there, which are kind of have the most broadest physics programs, but there are other experiments for flavor physics at LHCb and heavy ion physics at RIC. That's not Rick, Alice. That's the other. It's had two multi-year runs. The first one was at lower energy, 7 and 8 TeV, approximately half the design energy. and the last 4 years have been focused at 13 TeV, nearly equal to the design energy. And this was the facility that led to one of the most recent discoveries in our field, a new fundamental particle known as the Higgs boson. That is a consequence of a unified electron weak theory developed by Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow. And then with the Higgs boson and the Higgs field, there was this Brout-Englert Higgs mechanism, which ultimately led to the prediction of a new particle, a scalar particle. And in 2012, the CMS analysis experiments showed evidence of a new particle. This is a resonance in the gamma-gamma peak. And if you watch, you can see this time-lapse movie of events coming in the Z bosons. And they were both at the same mass, 125 GeV. And both Francois Englert and Peter Higgs were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2013 for the discoveries. Experimenters just got all the joy of finding it. So that's the context. And in fact, in the last year, so the discovery was in the coupling to bosons, which was actually the original reason to invent the mechanism to give mass to the gauge bosons. But it was also used to explain the mass of fermions. Those are the quarks and leptons that make up ordinary matter. And in the last year has been an exciting year, too, because we've basically established those couplings, at least to the third generation of fermions. We've established the observation of the Higgs coupling to top quarks, coupling the bottom quarks through its decay, as well as tau leptons through its decay. And these numbers here basically represent the ratio of what we measured to what we expected, and they're both all equal to one within their uncertainties. And there's a chart here which shows the coupling of the Higgs boson to vector bosons, and then versus the fermions, and the gray error ellipse is the combined measurement of all these different channels and searches and measurements, and so it is very much centered on 1-1 where we expect from the standard model of particle physics. Okay, my talk will focus mostly in the context of the CMS experiment. CMS stands for compact muon solenoid. Compact, just to define it for you, is 15 meters. All right, that's pretty small, right? Well, Atlas is bigger, that's why we're compact. We're compact because we have a rather powerful magnet, a 3.8 Tesla solenoid that's cylindrical, that contains most of the instrumentation and confines the bending to a limited region. And so inside we have tracking detectors made out of silicon sensors, a lot of electronics in there, surrounded by calorimetry, both crystal calorimetry and some brass scintillator calorimetry for measuring energies. Outside of the magnet, there are various wire chamber technologies for measuring muons. What's not shown in this picture of the detectors is mostly what I'll be talking about, is all the electronics behind that supporting it. There's a trigger and data acquisition system which takes 40 megahertz of beam crossing data from all these detectors and has to filter it down for storage down to only 1 kilohertz. So a rather sizable job to reduce the data rate. And I'll explain why it has to do that. This is just some picture to show what the CMS experiment looks like in reality when it's a bit opened up. So the magnet is this sort of cylindrical thing with a lot of cables attached to it. The beam pipe would be coming down the center to deliver the protons for colliding. The muon chambers are interspersed between iron disks here or on top of disks of iron to the right. And in total, with all those detectors, particularly the inert silicon tracking detectors, we're talking about of order 100 million individual electronic channels. So it's definitely big data and big computing that we needed. It was particularly viewed as big data and big computing because the LHC was conceived more than 30 years ago, and the experiments were designed already nearly 25 years ago. So to contemplate the data volumes I'm showing you a couple decades ago with the technology that you might remember, like Windows 3.1 or whatever it was, that was kind of tough to swallow. Okay, so let me also further set the context. So about the data acquisition for particle physics experiments, what do we mean by that? That's just the collection and storage of data recorded by a set of detectors comprising an experiment. And to initiate that data acquisition, you typically need some trigger, something to initiate it. And that means it's a set of conditions. It's usually multiple conditions, so we might refer to it as a menu of which to initiate that sequence to digitize data at the front end by the detectors, the front end electronics, turn it into numbers for processing. So it goes from analog sensors out to some numbers that are either stored or read out of local buffers. And then ultimately, the idea with the trigger is to select which data to store either to memory, disk, or tape storage. If you're a low-rate experiment, your trigger can be quite simple. Maybe it's a single pulse, a logic pulse, indicating the presence of some particle passing the detector or otherwise interacting in the experiment. But nowadays, you basically have to already start your data analysis and do a complicated reconstruction of the collision products from the detector data and apply a long list of criteria to decide whether ultimately to store the data or not. But why do we need such a trigger? So there are basically a couple reasons. The main one is that it otherwise would just be too much data to continuously stream to disk for storage. Either it's not going to be possible with the amount of bandwidth we have in the optical or copper cables reading that out, or it can also be that it's just too much data to realistically process with computer systems after you have stored it. Maybe you don't have quite that sizable a data center, and so you might have to limit how much you write. For example, to set context, an LHC experiment might generate, in raw data, 100 terabytes of data every second. So that's going to be a lot of data if you're doing your graduate student PhD to wade through and analyze if you didn't otherwise reduce it. There's another subtle point having to do with the electronics itself. Often when you try to initiate the readout and digitization of some data, that might induce a period where that particular piece of electronics and that detector are now dead. They can't take new data until you finish reading it out. So you also have a trigger so that you're not constantly busy. And so you can have some good near 100% live time. So as I said, it's really the first step of a data analysis. So the trigger is running in real time, so it's doing this analysis online, so we can think of it as an online data filtering system. And unfortunately, that means it's irreversible because you're choosing what to store and what you didn't. If you made a mistake, you can't go back and look at the data you didn't store. Right, it's gone. You only have to just start over. And for the LHC experiments, we're only keeping in the end about 1,000 hertz of collision beam crossing data. So we're essentially throwing out 99.998% of all the data. And you hope not to throw out the baby, the Higgs boson, out with the bathwater as you're doing so. And so by having a limited readout rate just for data processing reasons and storage reasons, already has made a judgment on what physics you're going to store, at least at the amount of it. So this is a plot of the center of mass energy for a particular collider. The LHC is this green line here sitting at 13 TeV. And these are various processes, these lines. And so the total cross-section for anything to happen when two protons pass and collide, it's about 0.1 barns, 100 millibarns. And so that's sitting up here. And this is a log plot on the rate. And so that total collision rate corresponding to that cross-section is about 2 gigahertz of collisions. Now, we don't get 2 gigahertz of the beams crossing. We're only getting 40 megahertz because we're actually colliding something like 50 protons every time the beams cross. So the data is naturally coming at 40 megahertz, but it's really 2 gigahertz of collisions for the maximum luminosity the LHC has achieved, 2 times 10 to the 34 hertz per square centimeter. So that's 2 gigahertz. We can keep 1,000 hertz, so we're at this line. I can keep the processes, all of them, below that line. So good, I can keep the Higgs boson. It has a rate of approximately 1 hertz of production. that you can see I have to wade through almost 9 orders of magnitude to find the Higgs out of the total collision rate. I can't keep all the B quarks I might produce. They're coming in at about 10 megahertz. I can't even keep all of the produced W bosons because they're coming in at 4 kilohertz, a little bit above my limit. So by having this this rate limit, we already have made a selection on what processes we can store. Of course, we can sample these other processes, and we do, but we just won't get the full statistics. Okay, so let me describe a little bit how trigger systems are designed at collider experiments. They're typically segmented into multiple levels with decreasing input rates and longer processing times, or also known as latencies. So the first level, level one, kind of has to face the whole data onslaught. It's coming in at 40 megahertz, all that data, those terabytes coming in, terabytes per second. And to deal with those kind of throughputs, certainly when we were conceiving this 20 years ago or so, we were envisioning custom electronic designs to handle that, and are still using it. And we only have microseconds to make processing decisions. So to implement that, we often use custom chips known as ASICs, or now we make use of programmable logic in devices called FPGAs, which I'll describe more of later. And then we try to take our processing and parallelize it as much as we can. You make a very maximally parallel processing. And since it might take microseconds to reach a decision, but the beam data is coming at 40 megahertz, which is 25 nanoseconds, we have to pipeline the data, meaning we can only do partial processing steps, and then we latch and hold the data as the new data comes in. So it's like a whole train, a wave of data coming through the processing logic. Let me jump to the last level, level three. That we can make use of commercial computing clusters, normal commodity CPUs, except we need of order 10,000 of them to do our current filtering. And there they might have up to about a second or so of processing time, not the microseconds. And we parallelize that processing by just sending different collision events to different computers. Some experiments possibly have a level two. CMS does not physically, but the Atlas experiment does. And that's going to be somewhere in between, some combination of custom electronics or accelerators. I'll say something about that, accelerating cards, and commercial computing equipment. One analogy I like to give for having the different levels is it's kind of like trying to launch a satellite to space. It would be very costly to launch it with a single stage because you have to carry all the fuel and lift that off and keep it so it keeps firing all the way till it reaches orbit. It's more efficient to drop some mass after you burn some fuel and then have a second or possibly third stage. So it's the same idea, but now in terms of data throughput. It's a cost optimization, how much custom electronics, how much computing. So to give an example, here is the CMS trigger architecture. As I said, it doesn't have that middle level, so it only has two levels. The level one, which is the custom electronics, which takes us from the 40 megahertz rate of data and filters out only 100 kilohertz of its best and favorite data. And it has to do it in 4 microseconds. So while it's thinking and making that decision, the data on the detector front ends are being kept in memory pipelines, waiting for a decision whether they should keep the data and then feed it to the next level or just go ahead and override and erase it. The high-level trigger, the one that made of commercial CPUs, goes from the 100 kilohertz for CMS down to the 1 kilohertz for storage. So again, data is held in buffers while it's doing so. The 100 kilohertz limit here is basically a design parameter for all that front-end electronics that has to hold the data, as well as the time, the 4 microseconds you have for processing. You want to lengthen the time or increase the rate, you have to increase the memory or modify the electronics to do so. So there was some design spec that richly set that. This limit is somewhat soft. You could run a 10 kilohertz for a while, but maybe only for 1/10 the time. Otherwise, you're going to flood your computer data centers. Okay. Anyway, in a nutshell, a trigger system is a real-time data processing system. I'll give you some example of the hardware we use for the level one part, the custom electronics. So this is some pictures of the cards that we designed in the University of Florida. They make use of a FPGA called the Vertex 7 family from the Xilinx Corporation. Data comes in on optical links at 10 gigabits per second, and it uses a telecommunications form factor and infrastructure known as micro TCA. And so these are a couple cards, and then those cards are installed into these racks of electronics for different systems, and then all kinds of fibers routing the data from one processor to the next. But I wasn't going to go into much description of this system, which is the current trigger system, because I'm going to actually focus on the next generation for this talk. But I should, you know, again, for those who may not be fully knowledgeable about this sort of electronics, let me just spend a little bit of moment, to describe FPGAs to you. That's FPGA stands for field programmable gate arrays. The gate array is basically digital logic gates in a big array on a silicon chip. And it's an off-the-shelf component. You can buy it from different vendors. So they're not like custom ASICs you have to design yourself. And you can think of it, if you knew what a breadboard was, where you can kind of wire up electronics any which way you want, it's basically, maybe another analogy, it's a blank slate. You know, you get to choose what you implement as a digital machine. It has configurable logic gates. It has offers memory. It has transceivers to both receive and transmit data at high speed. It has what are called digital signal processors. You might do multiplications and so forth, and so on. It's not quite a CPU, though. Even though you program these things, it's kind of digital logic below that. It's, you know, it's all the box of parts, the AND gates, the OR gates, the registers that you need to make a CPU. So you could program an FPGA to become a CPU, but it's probably just cheaper to buy one rather than program this. This is for custom uses. The state of the art is beyond the Vertex 7 I just showed you.
Maybe I can make a comment. Yes, yeah. You can buy a CPU, but if you implement one in FPGAs, probably you can run them at much higher speeds than the Intel Skylake CPUs.
Yeah, I mean, you can customize that design as you like. The CPU is basically might have been prototyped in an FPGA. Eventually, you will then burn it into a piece of silicon, and that because it's cheaper to produce that way. And maybe you can actually make it a bit faster. I'm not quite sure. I'm not an expert how that would work. Okay. Thanks for the comment. So the state of the art now is from Xilinx. I'm biased, but there's also Altera, Intel. Is their UltraScale Plus family in terms of IC technology? It's a 16 nanometer technology, and they can offer up to nearly 2 million of what they call configurable logic blocks. This is like a six-bit lookup table where you can implement some digital logic. And so essentially you have millions of logic gates you can deploy in one chip, 12,000 of these DSPs, which can do multiplications or accumulations, whatever you want, and even up to over 100 transceivers running at 32 gigabit per second. So you can really ship terabits of data per second into the chip and out of the chip. And of course, so many megabits of RAM as well. So they do have a lot of resources in there. It's a lot of logic. And interestingly, there's ever more powerful ways on how to configure those FPGAs. So there are the latest developments now are high-level synthesis languages, which allow you to write firmware for the FPGA, but in a way that's really more like a C++ program with some additional constraints, but it really is like that. So the Xilinx Corporation has this language called Vivado HLS, and literally you could compile that with a C++ compiler. Intel Altera has fallen mostly along the OpenCL area, but it's a very similar idea, very general purpose language. And so the tool that they offer is basically, you can think of it as a special type of compiler which allows you to describe your digital design in a high-level way, and the tool will take care of translating it to what's known as a high-level language description. Translate that description to hardware description language like VHDL Verilog, which have been for many decades commonly used to describe electronics. So it basically the advantages of this thing are multiple. By using a language which is closer to C or C++ as your design entry, it allows developers to reduce their development time. You don't have to be such an expert on how you write your VHDL and Verilog. And actually, for what we do, for physics purposes, we can take our description of our logic in a chip, and we can actually embed it within the C++ code environment of our experiment and run it and get an exact simulation of what that chip did. But of course, if you're trying to program an FPGA, you don't want it to run a simulation. You turn that into firmware and ultimately a special binary file, which you load in, which configures all the logic elements together. Anyway, just for those who weren't aware of what FPGAs are, just to kind of show what they're about. What do we put into the logic? Let me just pick one example. There's multiple different problems we're trying to execute in them. This one is trying to find muons in the muon system. So you take that picture I had of the experiment. The silicon tracker is somehow deep inside. outside were all those wire chambers, and so here's a candidate event going into four muons. And let's take the one that went out this way. It went through multiple detectors, and you're trying to basically in your logic do the pattern recognition to see, are there hits in these chambers which kind of line up and are consistent with a particle traversing them? And just for detailed reasons, in the NCAP regions, we had to actually do 3D, three-dimensional tracking algorithms. In the barrel, the magnetic field's uniform, so we were able to do two-dimensional tracking, but just a detail. But along with finding the muon, that's not enough. There's actually more than a megahertz of muons coming out of an LHC. Coming out of the collisions, we can only store 1 kilohertz, so we're going to have to apply a threshold, a momentum threshold. So we need to be able to also do a momentum measurement even at level 1 using the deflection. For tracking systems, you have to look at the deflection in a magnetic field to figure out the momentum. And this is just some scatter plot showing the angles between two detectors, the first and second detector and the second and third. Low momentum is a red, higher momentum is green, and you can see that there's a dependence. And so you develop algorithms kind of from where you are in some phase space. This is just two-dimensional. In reality, we're using n dimensions. Try to infer whether it was high momentum or low momentum. In fact, there are known algorithms to do that tracking and find the momentum. A traditional one used in high-energy physics known as the Kalman filter, used in a lot of tracking. And that actually, in our experiment, has been put into an FPGA. There was firmware developed to implement this just for the barrel region. Remember, it was just two-dimensional, so it simplified things. We haven't done the three-dimensional one yet. and so that was implemented, and this is kind of just a cartoony picture of that logic, the logic cells it's implementing inside the FPGA itself. And it's using roughly about half the chip resources. It depends on exactly which resource. The logic lookup tables, it's using 60%. The DSPs, they're only about 30%. But, you know, it fits within the chip, actually the chip we have deployed right now in the trigger system of CMS, so we can use it. And in fact, it was used. It was tested as a default trigger during run 2, which just ended, and turns out, last December, and we got good results. So we're looking at using this Kalman filter in an FPGA for the next LHC run. In the NCAP, we aren't yet using a Kalman filter, but we did our own developments there. So again, this was some of that technology we're currently using, these micro TCA modules. It's actually a double module, one that has the FPGA and memory, and another one that has all the optical link receivers. But circled here is a very large piece of memory, 1 gigabyte. Well, it doesn't sound very large, but it's a large piece of memory that can work very fast. So it's this reduced latency DRAM, and we use it as a large lookup table for the momentum calculation. So we'll run our tracking algorithm, or at least our momentum algorithm, offline, and then code it into a lookup table. And in fact, the current algorithm is actually based on machine learning, and I'll describe more of that later. And we use it to do regression to find the momentum. In fact, we have some redundancy if we go through at least four. If we go back and go through four chambers, we have some redundancy. So the machine learning is smart enough to figure out when there might be a bad measurement and throw out the outlier. We used to have to do this offline, if you like, with human logic. We'd write a simple algorithm to try to throw out outliers. Now it does better than us. Of course, we had to train it, so we're smarter still, right? Okay. After the level one trigger comes the high level trigger. So just to complete the story, after you've processed it by level one and you decide to keep an event, you've got to go ahead and initiate the detector readout and send it all that data through first a network switch and then to a very large data center. And this right now for CMS, we actually have up to 26,000 CPU cores. The network switch has changed in technology between the first LHC run and the second. We went from MiriNet to InfiniBand, in case you're interested. The high-level trigger, as I said, a lot of CPUs. It's a software-based filter, so it's just normal C++ software. And it's, in the end, selecting about 1,000 hertz for storage, about a megabyte per event, so that gives you about gigabytes per second coming out. And it has, like I said, of order a second, on average, about 300 milliseconds of event processing time per 100 kilohertz of data coming from the level one. And then, so what can the high level trigger do beyond what level one did? So first of all, its role is to reduce from 100 kilohertz to 1 kilohertz. But remember, level one already reduced it from 40 megahertz. So the sample data sample is already enriched in physics, and it already suppressed it by factor 400. So it has some extra work it's got to figure out how to do. But it does have no I/O limitations, or at least fewer than the level one has, and you can run algorithms very close to offline analyses. It also can bring in additional detector information. The level one trigger currently does not make use of the inner silicon pixel or strip tracking detector systems, which give you very high precision for charged particles. That we can only do at HLT, and so the resolution for muons goes from 20% at level one to only 2% at HLT. So you get better precision, more information, and so you can make a better judgment on where to place thresholds, or at least what the efficiency at those thresholds. Also, you can run more sophisticated algorithms. You have software, so you can take JET algorithms and run the much more mainstream algorithms than what the level one trigger in electronics can do. You might even run JET substructure algorithms to tag boosted top quark decays or boosted W decays. You can apply isolation using tracking around your leptons. You can use the pixel data to do BJET tagging. You can make various topology requirements or even invariant mass requirements on your final states. And so after you've done that analysis of your collision data, you then can compare it against what I called a menu list of requirements on see if any of these items are met, and therefore the event should be stored. So that's what I refer to as a trigger menu. It's a rather large set of selection criteria that has to represent the broad physics program of the experiment. So for example, let's just make a menu of two things. One trigger might be that we require two muons of opposite charge, one of them with a momentum above 17 GeV and the other one above 8 GeV. That's called a trigger line or a menu item or an entree, if you like, on the restaurant menu. And that's one condition that has to be met. Another condition might be, okay, we find some number of jets, and the total transverse energy of those jets has to exceed half a TeV, 500 GeV. That's another entree or another trigger line. And very crudely speaking, there's of order one trigger or trigger line per analysis top-end experiment. It's not literally one-to-one for every analysis, but of order, same number. The preference is to have some very general triggers that serve many analyses and thus have little bias on the physics that you expect, so you're not blind. But some are very sophisticated and therefore only attacking a specific physics process. We also have many backup triggers to help with control regions and data analyses, which further increases the count. Anyway, all said and done, there's a menu both for level one and HLT. For CMS, it has about 300 items on level one and about 600 for the HLT. So it's a lot of triggers. And this is just a snippet going from, I don't know, 490 to 517. A lot of cryptic names you probably won't be able to read. Muon 27, electron 37. So this is a muon electron trigger. And those are the thresholds, 27 GeV or 37 GeV. OK, so that was kind of set up the story of what trigger systems are, what the current state of the art, at least as far as what's been deployed. The rest of the seminar is focusing on the future. So first, let me start with, and mostly on the LHC. So this is a timeline. We are here at the start of 2019. And so we see we've just entered a long shutdown period for the LHC, where they're going to upgrade some of its accelerator components, and the experiments are going to upgrade some of their detector and electronic components. One of the interesting things is the LHC is going to increase its center of mass energy from 13 TeV to 14. That's good for physics reasons. And it will also increase slightly the amount of luminosity it can provide, how much data. So we'll go from 150 inverse femtobarns, and we hope to get up to 300 by the end of that next run, starting in 2021 and bringing us to 2023. Then there'll be a much bigger upgrade and shutdown period, where now the LHC will increase its luminosity by a factor of 4, roughly. So 4 times higher luminosity to accrue ultimately a data sample 10 times larger by the end of the HLHC lifetime. And that would be starting around 2026. So bringing us to the mid-2030s. And that's going to require a major new upgrade of detector components, I'll show you next, and the trigger system. So here's a picture, at least for the CMS experiment, of the planned upgrades to the detector elements. For example, the NCAP calorimetry on each end of the experiment is going to be upgraded to a scintillator-based, not scintillator plus silicon-based system. The silicon part of the calorimeter will have very fine resolution, just like it does for tracking, which will allow us to essentially image the shower development in the calorimeter, and hopefully also be able to help us separate those particles which came from different collisions, different proton collisions from the main one you're interested in. There's also, in fact, I'll describe a new tracking system that is trigger capable. There's even a completely new system added, a timing detector, also to help with the pileup. Some new muon detectors, additional readout changes. And then what I'll focus on is improvements to the level one trigger and DAQ system. And I just know here that TIFR is involved, at least two of these systems, both the trigger and the high granularity calorimeter. Right, so trigger. So let me focus on the trigger for this talk. So the challenge is we need to cope with the higher collision rate and particle densities that this upgrade will provide. Yet, we want to maintain the same thresholds in our trigger menu that we currently use at the LHC. Because we're after the same physics, the electroweak scale physics, there's no point in raising thresholds and reducing how many big Higgs bosons we log to disk. If we reduce that, then we don't gain the statistics by having higher luminosity and just we don't do a better measurement. So we need to maintain the threshold, which means we need a better trigger system. And then to that, we can add sensitivity to new things, things we maybe weren't accepting before. We can pick various exotic scenarios from possible new physics models. We can look for muons which are not coming directly from the particle collision, the collision vertex for the particles. They're displaced somehow from the nominal collision vertex, maybe by a lot, like a meter. Or we can look for maybe highly ionizing, heavy, stable charge particles. Particles that might be traveling slowly, less than the speed of light. And so these are new things we could add to try to increase our sensitivity. So now a bit about the requirements of the CMS trigger for the HLHC upgrade. We're going to go ahead and allow the front-end electronics to be able to be read out faster. So we'll go from 100 kilohertz to nearly 1 megahertz. Not quite 40, sorry. And we'll increase the amount of time for level one from 4 microseconds to 12.5. Both those requirements imply changes to the detector front ends. One of the major other new additions, that those are design specifications, they have implications of the electronics, but we're going to build a completely new type of tracking system out of silicon strips, which is trigger capable, something we couldn't do before. This recovers a capability that the Tevatron experiments had a generation ago, although they had less data throughput demands. So it's a major new change. And then ultimately, also what we write to storage will be higher. Instead of 1 kilohertz, we envision getting close to 10 kilohertz. OK, just a comment. So if we add tracking to level 1, and I said that tracking was a new thing that, or the thing that the HLT could do, what's left for the HLT to process? So you know, what else could it do? Well, it turns out that we're not going to add the pixel system to level 1. So HLT can still do BJET tagging beyond what level 1 can do. It also never had all the computing resources to do global tracking for all of the events coming to it. But now, with this adding of a silicon track trigger, the full collection of tracks can be available for every collision, that, well, at least every selected collision. And so we can now do a bit better with global tracking. And in fact, this is what the ATLAS experiment is implementing now, and also we'll have a next generation for this HLHC upgrade. They have something called a fast tracker. You can think of it as a custom hardware accelerator for your computers, which is finding tracks. All right, so now let's focus back at the level one trigger, though, and for CMS. So this is a kind of a block diagram showing the connections and data flow. Data's coming from the new detectors here at the top, flowing through the system ultimately to the global trigger of level one, which has to apply the menu and decide what to keep. So there's muon data coming in here in the right, Kelemeter data both in the middle and to the left. And then this is this new element that's the new trigger-capable tracking trigger, which we can now correlate with energy clusters and with muons to get better precision. And so we process that with a new layer. So just a few words about this new trigger-capable tracker. Let's focus on this shaded yellow region here on the right. So we have a collision, and let's imagine a particle coming out straight, basically into the barrel region. Each plane in the, or each sensing plane in this cylindrical barrel tracking region is actually going to be a doublet, two planes. And so you'll get two hits, one in the first silicon plane, one in the next silicon strip plane. They're only separated by a few millimeters. But will require a coincidence within a narrow enough window, sort of the green region. So this track went rather straight, so we would keep it. But if you're lower momentum because of the magnetic field, you're going to curve off. And so rather than hitting the green area, you've missed it, and you won't find a coincidence. So this is a data filter. It's not throwing away specific collisions. It's just filtering out lower momentum tracks and keeping only those above about 2 GeV, which is less than 3% of the track. So it helps reduce the data volume because the tracker gets most of the data. And this plot here is just showing the turn-on curve for different layers of the silicon tracking, both from inner layers to outer layers in red. And so you can see the threshold's about 2 GeV. Even so, even by filtering out most of the tracks, we're still going to deliver something like 10,000 stubs every bunch crossing of the beams, which is like of order 50 terabits per second. So it is a challenge still. So we have to design a system that can take that data and form those charged tracks. For CMS, we're going to push all the stubs out every beam crossing. We're going to give ourselves 5 microseconds to do it. And there's a couple ways you can do that. And here I'll bring Atlas back into the game. They plan to do it with so-called associative memory chips. And they're not going to do this at level one, but sort of in parallel between that and the high-level trigger. So these are custom ASICs, and they'll have a large number of about 1 billion track patterns that they match to, distributed on something like 10,000 chips. CMS is not doing that approach. We're going to make use of FPGAs, and we have two types of algorithms, one called a tracklet approach, basically extrapolating from one layer to the next. Or you can transform patterns, like in the Atlas approach, into a tracking space, and that's known as the Hopf transform. And both right now are being explored, and we'll see how this develops. The other thing is we'll generally implement this system, since it has so much data and needs so much processing, with kind of the way we run our high-level triggers. We're going to serve data in a round-robin fashion to different processors each subsequent bunch crossing. So it's going to kind of model the HLT, but now at level one. So not only by modeling it with adding tracking, we're modeling it even how we set up the architecture. And then, as I said, we're going to combine the tracking with the other elements, the energy clusters in the calorimeter, or the muons in the muon system that didn't have the track match yet. So we have to match them up. But we actually can match them in a more clever way. We can swim tracks out to where there are energy clusters, and then combine the momentum measurement with the energy measurement and get the best statistical combination. Of course, there will be tracks, or some clusters that don't have tracks matching. Those are called either pi zero decays to gammas, or they might be neutrons. But we can separate out what are electrons, what are photons, what are neutral hadrons, what are charged hadrons. And our ambitious goal, as we do this at HLT, is to try to implement this at level one in this two-layer correlator system I just mentioned to you. All right, I should say something about the technologies before I actually run out of time, so let me get to that now. So to implement this ambitious algorithms, we're going to take advantage of the next generations of data links. So there are optical data links available now that, in fact, I'll show you some tests that go up to 28 gigabit per second, and maybe around the corner will be 56 gigabit per second. That's an increase from the current 10 gigabits that I mentioned. So that allows us to ship the increased amount of data without necessarily increasing a huge number of links. I mentioned these ultrascale FPGAs that had of order 100 data links, receivers and transceivers, and transmitters, and have factor 4 more logic resources. So we can do more logic, take more data in. We can make bigger memory banks, and we're going to take use make use again of the telecommunications industry and settle on ATCA as our kind of standardized shelf technology. Just to flash a little bit, other institutes have done this too, but in Florida we've done some R&D on these high-speed optical links. There's one flavor known as the Firefly, and we've tested it from 14 all the way up to 28 gigabits per second using a Xilinx UltraScale Plus FPGA. We try to do this in a realistic way where either the data has to go through a connector from one card to the next, we modeled that, or you might have had a fiber interconnect, and so we put that in there. So we made a realistic connection and then see if the links work. This is where you make what are so-called eye diagrams. It's essentially the envelope of rising and falling signals on a line at the clock, around the clock transition. And basically, the center part, you want to be open. That means blue in this diagram. You don't want any signals in there because that's where you might be latching the data. It should be 0 or 1. You don't want it indeterminate. You'll get errors. So we've tested that, and basically we had error-free operation, even up to 28 gigabits per second. And so we're going to use this on our next generation technologies. So what might that look like?
Yeah. I
forget what the acronym stands for, but this is on the Xilinx chip itself. To make these clean eye diagrams, they actually do some of the corrections and synchronization internally. And so they have some circuitry, they refer to as CDR, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what the acronym stood for, but you enable that, and it helps recover and clean up that data. Okay, so that technology can be deployed on some new cars, so there's some R&D going on by different consortia of institutes. There's more than just what I show here. But one flavor is now known as the Serenity collaboration. Here you see two Xilinx ultrascale Kintex FPGAs on a board. They can have 72 transmit and receive links per FPGA card. They're on daughter cards. And in fact, TIFR is working on the very large FPGA version, VU9P, of that daughter card. I'm familiar with the APX consortia. We're doing a VU9P as well, but a single one on a card. We'll also have a rear transition module and about 100 links in and out of this card at up to 28 gigabits per second, plus a lot of memory. And so let me just focus on that one. If you're interested, this is the consortia of institutions in the US, including Florida. As you can see, it's mostly in the layout stage for the main board, but some pieces have come in. So this is the rear transition module. That brings in some of the optical links. The rest come from the front panel. As I said, there's 100 of them, up to 28 gigabits per second. There's a very large FPGA here, which this board is not yet back from the assembler, so we can't show you a picture. Mainly targeting the VU9P, but it's also footprint compatible with some other chips, maybe cheaper ones. We use the Xilinx Zinc chip for an embedded Linux system for monitoring and control. In fact, there's two of them. There's an IPMC mezzanine card, as well as a MADE control board. And there's an Ethernet switch as well to go between the two of them. There's also, as I said, going to be a large memory, 128 gigabytes. That also exists now, and so that module has been tested for very large lookup tables. Okay, so maybe in the last part here, it's not strictly speaking the hardware technology, it's now more the technology of what you deploy into that hardware and firmware, which is artificial intelligence now into trigger systems. So machine learning has been very, obviously very prevalent nowadays all across the world, right? We generate data everywhere. Internet of Things, just people clicking on web pages, we analyze all that. And it's been used in particle physics actually for decades, but now quite extensively as well. In fact, all the Higgs boson measurements now basically make use of some machine learning algorithm somewhere. Could be low level for clustering energy or high level for finding signal over background. In the level one trigger, we already are running an algorithm now called based on a boosted decision tree to do that momentum regression of muons. But we computed this offline, and we stored the results in the memory. So the calculation, the tree is not implemented in the logic, but the results of that tree are. But what's interesting nowadays is another flavor, neural networks, is another AI type algorithm, that actually, as well as BDTs, can fit now inside the FPGA logic. And so that's very interesting. And one thing I'd like to note is, you know, everyone's doing AI nowadays. Our unique use in particle physics is we need very fast inference. We need results in under a microsecond, which, you know, for human timescales, you can wait longer than a microsecond. But here we need it really at 40 megahertz. What's the answer? So I'll say very briefly both approaches. Maybe I'll kind of go very quick over the boosted decision tree given the time. So let me skip the details on how we trained it. As I said, we didn't actually calculate in real time. The trees were run in a software program offline, and we stored the results in a large memory. Hence, that was why we're putting 128 gigabytes on the hardware R&D. And so it's kind of a cheat, but it was really computed. But it has to work off the data. The calculation has to work off data that fits into the address bit of that chip, or that memory chip. So that can be a small number, like 30 bits. And so that's a challenge in itself to squeeze all that data down. That's the challenge. So let me skip over that. The current generation I showed you, the 1 gigabyte, the next generation that I flashed is 128 gigabytes, gives us 7 more address bits, a few more features we can put into the AI algorithm, if you like. And then we've done some work, it's a data science in itself, to try to squeeze that data in to an address of 30 or 37 bits. So this is us, our table of our results trying to do that and train it. And we actually improved the trigger. So when we went to that boosted decision tree, we went from this is rate, the magenta curve, it's also covering the barrel, to the red histogram. So we cut the rate substantially by using this more intelligent algorithm. Intelligent in the sense that it figured out all the correlations to find the momentum. But let me focus then in remaining time on deploying neural networks into electronics. So how does a neural network work? It's basically loosely modeled by how neurons work in the brain. You have, say, a dot here, which is a neuron in the brain, and it's connected to many neighbors around it. And so they transmit signals from one to many other neurons, and those neurons transmit their signals on to other things. And in that way, it turns out you can actually train this, the emulation of that, you can train it to recognize things, maybe kind of analogous to what the human brain might be doing. So essentially, it's a mathematical function, though. You have a set of data, your inputs, so some numbers. Each of those inputs is connected to every neuron in the next layer. Those are so-called hidden layers. And then each of those neurons, in turn, are connected to every neuron in the subsequent layer. This is a so-called feed-forward network. And the mathematical process is, when you get a data from the layer before it, you're going to multiply by a weight. So here's some weight times the data. For each data element of the layer before, and then you're going to sum it all up, possibly adding a constant offset. And then after that, you've done that sum, you will give it a mathematical transformation. And popular ones are a hyperbolic tangent, for example, or something called a sigmoid or whatever. These are all just design decisions as you come up with a well-performing neural network. A deep neural network would have many of these hidden layers. We like to think ours are deep with 3 layers, but you know, it's really convolutional neural nets with maybe many tens of layers, which are what people consider deep nowadays. And they're used for image recognition. As I said, you have to train it. That's where the work is. You have to give it examples, either from simulation or data, of what you want and what you don't want. So if it's image recognition, you want to find a cat, and you give it examples of what's not a cat, and then you apply it, and you see when it finds a cat. Or for our analyses, what's a Higgs boson, what's not a Higgs boson? Or for trigger purposes, a muon with momentum 10 versus a muon with momentum 100. So that's the other generalization. And as I said, the level one trigger needs the results very fast. So what I wanted to flash today, though, is some other collaborators have developed something that they refer to as the HLS for ML toolkit. HLS from that high-level synthesis language, ML for machine learning. There's the reference here if you'd like it, to allow you to instantiate the inference of a neural network into an FPGA and thus be very fast. Essentially, the tools you use to create neural networks, it can process the output of those tools, all those weights and so forth from the nodes, and feed it into the Vivado HLS firmware synthesis tool. And from that, allow you to be able to derive the bit file that you can load into an FPGA. It makes extensive use of the DSPs inside the FPGA, these things that can do multiplications of 18-bit, even 27-bit by 18-bit numbers. And FPGAs nowadays, what was kind of new, I kind of missed this when it first came up, but now I really appreciate it. You know, now there's many thousands of these DSPs inside a modern FPGA, you know, even the largest ones up to 7,000. So you have a large fabric of these things that you can implement. And this toolkit will optimize the use so that you can minimize how many DSPs you use and how fast it can run. So we prototyped this. We made one of these three-layer neural networks to do momentum regression. So it wasn't too deep, but you know, it still takes a lot of events to train. The reason we wanted to prototype a neural network is it gets rid of the bottleneck of our memory lookup table approach. Right? We use BDTs, but you had to fit all your data into just 30 bits. Here we can relax that, not to infinity, but I can have 40 variables. Each of them might be, you know, 16 bits. So I have a lot more precision. So I might get better performance. The idea is to train this thing to give a regression output. What is the momentum of the muon given these inputs? We also had another classifier about whether it was more consistent with background versus real signal. I won't go into that detail, but it actually finds two things. And we first trained the algorithm, and we saw how it did. And we actually achieved a factor 4 reduction in the trigger rate. So the lookup table approach is the red, the neural net the blue. And we achieved a lot of reduction. Of course, we were prototyping this neural net along with using new data from new muon detectors. So we kind of added two things. What we need to do now is go back and figure out how much the neural net added on top of the additional data. So we'll work on that. It did also improve the efficiency. So then we put it into this new HLS for ML toolkit. We created some firmware. We targeted Vertex 7 FPGA. That's what we're deploying now. I have deployed now. And it turns out it does fit in the FPGA resources. It fits there 78% of the DSP usage. And the latency is well under a microsecond, 160 nanoseconds. And in fact, we've tested it now in real hardware, the actual boards that I've shown you pictures of. And the results agree with the expectation. So our hope is that we're going to deploy this for the next LHC run, if indeed we show that it works better. If this is borne out, those that performance.
What was the number for the lookup table technique?
Which number?
Your
back there?
The previous slide.
One more?
One back.
I'm not sure.
Probably I missed.
Yeah. Okay.
The comparison between the lookup table versus the neural network for the same trigger, did you have a comparison?
I don't have a honest comparison of just BDT neural net for the same inputs. That I don't. We decided to try, since someone put out this group put out this toolkit, we said, oh, let's try this out. And it does work very well. We were impressed. But we should go back and try our tried and proven technique, train it with additional data and make sure. But that requires actually more human work, not just throwing up our hands and letting the machine train. So it's the humans are slower than the darn machines. Okay, and this is just showing that from the readout of the hardware that signals were doing what they should have done. So I'll try to wrap it up here. I think we've used the hour. There are some other tasks we might imagine using artificial intelligence for beyond just regression. As I mentioned, there's other new physics signatures that we may not be quite sensitive to yet in the current trigger system. Maybe we should add that into the new one. And so perhaps we can use AI to identify those types of signatures. For example, I mentioned this displaced muon, so those are particles that don't seem to come from the collision point. Or maybe there's just sprays of muons, either from a lepton flavor violating decay of a tau lepton, or just some new supersymmetry model making lots of lepton jets. So you can imagine using one of these algorithms to take that raw data and try to, if you like, do the facial recognition, now not of a cat, but of a particular type of decay. We haven't done any of this, but just speculation, okay? To give you an example why I want to put that speculation is, in fact, neural networks are used for some recognition of particle collisions. This is not from the LHC, this is from the NOVA experiment, where they developed a convolutional neural net to determine what type of neutrino interaction took place in their detector. So a neutrino comes in here, it's invisible, at a certain point it interacts with the nucleus, and there'll be some number of particles coming out. And this is just two views, one from the top and from the side. And you want to classify what kind of interaction it was, what physicists want to know. So they developed this multi-level convolutional neural net, one for each view, starting from the bottom, going up to the top, and you can find it in their reference here. And so the idea is they run that in software, but maybe someday we're going to be putting this in the chips and then have it classified in real time in the trigger level. And then finally, another interesting speculative development. You know, we're used to now having GPUs as accelerator cards inside computers to do some compute-intensive tasks, like graphics processing mostly, but we can use it also for training AI, your algorithms, because that's very computing intensive. But what's interesting now is FPGAs are also becoming available as computing accelerator cards. Microsoft and Amazon both offer services that offer that. And so one can start to prototype on those services, but then that might kind of blur the distinction between level one and high level trigger, because you have an FPGA for very fast things you need to do, and you have a normal CPU, and maybe even a GPU too, for not quite as fast things, but more akin to traditional software algorithms. So maybe you can have just one compute node and do all the trigger levels. That might be interesting. Or maybe we can spy on the data that's coming through and do in situ training on data. So these are just some speculative ideas. And then this is not to have anything to do with AI, but just to mention there, perhaps. If the technology advances enough, you can just do away with the electronic trigger level altogether. And the LHCb experiment is doing just that in these next 2 years. They have an upgrade to remove their electronic trigger system and read out their electronics at full, at least the full inelastic collision rate of 30 megahertz straight into their software-based computing cluster. Now, they can do it because they're a limited reach experiment. They only cover part of the 4pi solid angle. And they have room to bring cables out and all the data out and cooling and power. It's much more challenging for a 4pi experiment like Atlas and CMS. But we went to 1 megahertz, which is not, you know, it's a factor 10 more rate than we originally started with. So maybe we'll get to the 40 megahertz. And then finally, to end with, I'm sorry to take your time. If we think in the distant horizon beyond the LHC and HLHC, if we really have to go to higher energies to try to find evidence of supersymmetry, other new particles, there's ideas of 100 TeV machines, which are 100 kilometers in circumference for at least hadron colliders, at unprecedented luminosities, 20 times more than the LHC, and delivering of order 1,000 proton collisions at once. To handle such a device, you would need new detectors, which are incredible in granularity to separate those 1,000 proton collisions, able to deal with unprecedented radiation levels at the inner tracking regions. And you're going to have an enormous amount of data to read out. And so this is going to require new ideas, new technologies to tackle that next order of magnitude. I don't have any ideas here. This is for the rest of the audience, for the new generation of physicists and engineers to tackle how to deal with that. And so let me just end. Sorry to take the time. I hope I showed you we can embed AI algorithms into electronic processor designs, such as in the CMS trigger. Our unique requirement in particle physics is sub-microsecond inference. And I showed you some of our hardware R&D embedding this, as well as traditional algorithms as well. I will mention, we do have some concerns on things like neural networks deployed in real-time systems, because what happens if it gets faced data that you never trained it with? Like a detector fault happens. It will give a result. Who knows what it is? So we do need to work on ensuring that the training is robust so the results are predictable. And then the next big challenge might be how to use FPGAs as accelerators for training AI or doing particle physics triggering. So thank you, and I will stop there.
Yeah, thank you very much, Naren, for a very comprehensive talk, which of course touched the physics goals and physics aspirations of new experiments. But also very nicely projected the technologies at work that are going to take care of this very complex job in the coming decades. So, if there are some questions, yes, Krishna.
Could you talk a little bit about
Yes.
You want to work on ensuring that the training is robust, so that the results are predictable.
Yes.
What is it, you know, I mean, if you went through a logical sequence and thinking of steps to go through, that's one thing. The other thing here is training which results in an empirical set of coefficients for multiplying and a neural network. It's not so tractable to human logic. So what is it that constitutes your understanding that training is robust in fact?
So let me clarify, because you know, I was used up all your time, so I was rushing a little bit. So what I mean, what I'm particularly concerned about, but maybe it's not the only concern I should I should have. Right now we're using simulated data, and we can try to, we know what the physics processes are that we expect, and that's probably mostly what we will see. The issue is what happens when you have detector issues, like one disk of muon chambers just goes off. We had the cooling, whatever. If it's a major thing, we're going to shut down the experiment and try to fix it. But sometimes you run in a degraded state. A few detectors are off. That always happens. The point is, if your training sample never had cases like that, it might say, oh, this is a high momentum muon every time. So all of a sudden, my trigger rate, which was sitting there at, say, 1 kilohertz, just jumped to 1 megahertz. We'll notice that right away in the control room. And we'll have to stop, but we'll be scratching our heads. Why? What? Well, it's just this chamber went off. Why am I getting 1 megahertz? So that's the point. So what I mean here is, I was going to have my student who's working on this. We need to put these faults into the training sample so that it figures out that no, it really wasn't a TeV muon. It was really just a 10 GeV muon, and so maybe it can start to learn to tolerate it. The previous algorithm was this boosted decision tree, and since we had to squeeze the data down so small and we had to train it for different types of detectors involved, it kind of built into that construction the ability to handle those faults. Eventually, yes, if you remove too many detectors, you will have lousy performance. You'll get a megahertz rate. But it was a little bit more controlled. Here, right now, you're right. It's a lot of multiplications and things that we can't necessarily vision in our human brain. So that's why I say we have to study and try to give it faults. Ultimately, you will
Yeah. You have an empirical sample.
Yes.
Which, okay, every time on every one of your inputs, it seems to give the right thing.
Yes.
But what is it that leaves you confident that something that you haven't researched?
This is a really good question. So let me start with just, let's say it's a simple trigger, like I'm trying to find the momentum of a muon. There is a very nice way I can see how it's doing. But I have to analyze some data. So I let the trigger work. Who knows if it's right or wrong, right? And I take some data. Now, hopefully it's not so wrong that I don't get any muons, right? So let's assume I get some muons. Some muons will come from a Z decay. So if I have a Z boson and it decays to, you know, two muons, I can ask to trigger on this muon, that's my tag, and then I can study the efficiency of my probe. And so I can see, well, how often did my trigger system, which has this new neural network algorithm, how did it find this momentum of the muon? And I can make a curve. I can plot then versus, say, its PT, some efficiency curve of my probe. And I can see, well, it should have had a threshold of 20 GeV. Do I see something like this that goes to 100% or near 100% to top? If I see the threshold where it should be, I know at least it got the momentum calibrate right, and I can do this for different thresholds. And if it doesn't do this, come down at high momentum where it's losing efficiency, if it has the right behavior, I haven't necessarily directly proved explicitly that it's right, but you know, it's walking and talking like a duck, quacking, and it seems to have the right properties. I don't care anymore because I know I'm efficient. So that's one way to convince myself. Now, if I'm looking for some unique signature, tau to 3 muon, which is lepton flavor violating, I've never seen one. I don't have a sample to show it in data other than simulation. That you have to trust yourself with simulation, I guess, that it's getting it right.
So. Yeah. A lot difficult, lot more difficult for these algorithms to work here in online than you projecting, you know, pretending or whatever, showing the image processing kind of algorithms where quite often these things can fail, but it doesn't have a repercussions in some sense. But I understand that the training, the neural network trainings particularly, those tech, I mean, you talked about one where using FPGAs for accelerator, but the clouds are helping a lot in terms
yeah.
of getting a lot.
I didn't dwell on the training part here, but that is the compute intensive
yeah.
part. And
yeah.
we need to make use of resources like that to get ever more training. You might need a billion events, not a million events, for example,
yes.
if it's a deeper network.
Yes. Yeah, one, yes.
What is the type of background you use for the training?
The type of background? Oh, so, yes. So for the muon, if I'm doing the muon momentum regression, which I use an example, there it was really just one sample, but we were trying to find momentum. So the truth was the momentum of the muon. But there was this thing I called the pileup discriminator, which meant that's kind of the background, and it had to classify, was it a good muon or junky pileup induced muon? There the background was just ordinary proton collisions, maybe with or without a muon. And so it's really not, I mean, any, if there was any muon hit, it probably was a real muon, but it was kind of the low momentum ones that we don't want. So the background is kind of ordinary proton collisions versus the thing I want. But if it's a signature type thing, you would, I guess, give it your signal and then everything else, right? I'd give it tau to 3 muon, lepton flavor violation, and then I would just give it muons from B jet decays, from W and Z boson decays, and say, I don't want those.
Okay, are there any more questions? Yeah, I know we are running short, but if I can make just maybe 30 seconds
okay.
remark.
Sure.
Not just today, but what I've kind of saw you talking about lots of technologies for the last few years. There has been a kind of, I would say, change in the way that we build instrumentation for high energy physics. Olden days where we actually built most of it in-house, build things ourselves, but now we see a lot of commonality or, you know, I would say, the common use of technologies which are developed more on the commercial domain, whether it is electronics, whether it is communication systems, computing systems, you know, you talked about high-speed links and so on and so forth. And so, I mean, I'm not even talking about software side, which there are also databases and
yeah.
application programs, etc. So, in the big experiments, especially now I'm talking about your high luminosity and also maybe FCC, etc. Is there going to be a big change in terms of an experiment is planned, in terms of what kind of engineering going to be done in-house, what kind of things are going to get done commercially, you know, not just buying off the shelf, but actually
yeah.
working closely with them?
Yeah, I think there is a transition. I mean, Trigger is one of those places where, you know, I think, you know, in the earliest days when I was a young kid as a grad student, you know, things were wire wrapped. It was a custom design.
Yes,
right?
Yes, custom.
So even maybe individuals, tiny few pin chips and some transistors, that was custom. Then you started being able to buy your ADCs and your amplifiers and so forth. And then you started just buy pre-built modules. I think what we're seeing in level and trigger, and that kind of touches on the heterogeneous thing, we're still designing these custom cards with the FPGAs. But there's only probably one reason we're doing that, and that's because we have such a huge I/O demands for that card. You can get a Xilinx evaluation card with a big, massive FPGA. It just won't have the 100 links into it. As soon as somebody offers that, honestly, we're just going to be buying it. You know, I don't see the need, unfortunately, because I like doing this stuff. I don't see the need it's just that closed that chapter. But there are other chapters opening. I mentioned all those upgrades at the very beginning for the HLHC. I won't try to find which side, it was too far back. But there was like this MIP timing detector, or even the high granularity calorimeter.
Yes.
Somewhere near the front end, or even downstream, there is some unique need. Picosecond timing resolution. I mean, okay, we're going to have to do something in-house. Yeah. So there will always be a need, but it's going to move, right? You know, we can keep trying our horse and buggy, but eventually just go to the automobile, if I may.
Okay.
I have one more slide I forgot to show. This was my first trip to TIFR in Mumbai and India. So anyway, thank you for the invitation to give all these lectures. Florida's environment is different than India. There's some things in common. Our weather is probably very similar. I notice you have mangroves around in India. We have mangroves in Florida as well, in the Everglades. So if you ever get a chance to come to the U.S., let me just advertise Florida to you. To go to the Everglades in the south, who knows, with climate change, it might disappear. So go soon. Just kidding. So these are some mangroves in the water. The Everglades are basically water everywhere. And over the winter break, I went with my son. We went canoeing through them. It was just a wonderful experience. So just to advertise a little bit about Florida to you and to thank you for my visit here.
Yeah, of course. So just give me a minute. Okay. So that made me also say this. Daring was, of course, very much loaded. Also, he gave his talks. He also gave a talk outside Mumbai in VJTI. Of course, he gave an asset. And so thank you very much once again. But we also want to give you little pieces more to bring back to you. I know you have a book on the paintings, but if you want to frame some of those paintings here, there are, I think there are five in a
in very
set.
Nice.
Also a nice book written on Baba.
Okay, I can learn some more Baba stories. Okay.
Nicely written.
Excellent.
And,
wow.
So if you want to sit in one of those places and want to sip a coffee, this is what it is.
Wow.
This is one of the painting that
you'll see. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, thank you. So please join for tea just outside the West Canton.